Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 30, 2015. South Sudanese lawmakers set up an investigation into Maridi fuel tanker explosion as death toll surpasses 200.
I think it is very unfortunate. How do we consider ourselves as people, as leaders of the country, and we are not caring for the people who are dying?
And Australia pledges millions of dollars to help people affected by the conflict in South Sudan.
Even if peace is sustained, the suffering of the South Sudanese people will endure for some time. Humanitarian needs will remain acute.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese lawmakers launched an investigation into the deadly explosion of a fuel tanker 2 weeks ago near the Maridi town in western Equatorial State. Lawmakers from Maridi County say the death toll from the explosion is now over 200, and many of the victims are youth and children. Lawmakers say the government must put in place measures to prevent similar incidents from happening in the future. For VOA News, Philip Thonaleu reports from Juba.
Justin Joseph Marona represents Maridi County in the National Assembly. He told lawmakers at yesterday's legislative session that the toll from the tanker truck explosion has risen to 206. The chairman of the Maridi Community Association in Juba, Joseph Abrahoma, confirmed the new death toll. Many of the victims of the blast were trying to collect fuel that was leaking from the over 10 tanker when it burst into flame. Marona says a score of people died on the scene of the accident, and many more died later of the severe burns.
Sizable number of people were burned into ashes. Over 68 burned completely and buried in mass grave. Maximum losses in one of the clans reached 17 people. And there is one family lost 7 of its members. One foreigner from Uganda has disappeared, and one is now in Juba Teaching Hospital.
Marona says 180 people are still hospitalized following the accident, which is said to be the worst of its kind in South Sudan. Dr. Abraham Adut works at Juba Teaching Hospital, where 70 victims of the September 16th explosion were released for treatment. He says 3 of the victims died within days of arriving at the hospital, but the others are responding to treatment and recovering.
They are talking to people, they are talking and they are doing everything. Most of them, you can say almost 50 of them, they are recovering well and they can move on their own.
Adul says 20 doctors at Juba Hospital are attending to the survivors of the blast. Marona told his fellow lawmakers in the National Assembly that much more has to be done to support survivors of the accident and those who are trying to help them.
To urge the government, NGOs and other private sectors to urgently support Minister of Health so as it could immediately address the rising needs in Juba Teaching Hospital and Maridi Civil Hospital with the necessary beds, sheets and other medical tools and drugs.
Marona wants officials from the Defence and the Health Ministries to work with lawmakers to investigate the accident. Onyoti Adigo is the minority leader in South Sudan's parliament. He slapped the government's slow response following the accident.
The government, as if there had nothing happened, and we have to thank only the Minister of Health, who has shifted his office to Juba Teaching Hospital. What about those who are in Maridi? What about those who are in Azara? What about those who are anywhere? I think it is very unfortunate. How do we consider ourselves as people, as leaders of the country, and we are not caring for the people who are dying?
Adigo says there should have been a united and robust response to the oil tanker accident, which he says is the first of its kind in South Sudan. He also says fuel should be made available to every household in South Sudan so that people don't feel they have to rush out to an over 10 oil tanker to try to collect leaking fuel. Garwij Lam, who represents Upper Niles State, Nasir County, in the National Assembly, insisted the government is concerned about the welfare of its citizens. He says the five-member committee that lawmakers agreed to set up should ensure that fuel suppliers use good quality tanker trucks fitted with fire extinguishers to prevent similar accidents like the deadly one near Madidi happening again. Lam, who is also head of the Energy Committee in South Sudan Parliament, said he is also concerned about petrol stations that are located in residential areas. He says they also pose a danger to residents. Around 150 people died in a fire at a petrol station in Accra, the capital of Ghana, in June.
Imagine what will happen if it happened here in Juba. It will be a disaster. So it is an alarming bell to all of us as a government that we have to take things seriously.
Lam says as a first step to improve safety, Parliament's Energy Committee is working with the Ministry of Petroleum on laws to regulate the construction of fuel stations and to ensure that tanker trucks undergo regular maintenance. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleo in Juba.
VOA fellow Kaltuma Vanessa contributed to this report from Washington. In New York yesterday, Australia pledged an additional $10 million for what it calls emergency life-saving activities in South Sudan. Speaking during a high-level meeting on South Sudan on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly, Australia's Foreign Affairs and Trade Secretary Peter Vergesi said the funds will be donated to the Common Humanitarian Fund, which distributes aid money to international non-governmental organizations working in the country. Vergesi called on the international community to keep its promise of supporting peace in South Sudan, which he says includes an acceleration of humanitarian aid to the South Sudanese.
Even if peace is sustained, the suffering of the South Sudanese people will endure for some time. Humanitarian needs will remain acute. The cumulative effect of conflict, impeded access for aid, and the disruption of planting and harvesting and pastoral activities will not be easily overcome.
Vergesi urged President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar to cease hostilities and halt support for military forces who are violating the peace agreement they both signed last month. As a member of the UN Security Council in 2013-2014, Vergesi says Australia is calling on the Council to continue imposing sanctions on individuals who impeded peace in the country.
We were pleased that the Council did so and that these have had some impact. The Council should continue to exercise leverage over the parties. And the international community more broadly must sustain its attention to assist both parties meet their commitments to improve the welfare of the people of South Sudan and assist with a peaceful transition to a unified national government.
Vergesi says the latest donation brings Australia's total contribution to the country to more than $79 million since South Sudan became an independent in 2011. Yesterday, President Kiir told the meeting in New York that he will, quote, prove doubting Thomas is wrong as he implements the peace agreement brokered by the regional bloc IGAD. Mr. Kiir reiterated his reservation about the peace deal yesterday, but also said he would do his part to fully implement the agreement. South Sudanese lawmakers held their third national prayer breakfast today in Juba. This year, they prayed for peace in South Sudan. Information Minister Michael Makwi says he is certain that their prayers will be answered, but he says that peace may be longer in coming than expected. Philip Thonaleo reports for VOA from Juba.
Makwi told the prayer meeting that it is the duty of the government and Riek Machar's opposition group to lead efforts to bring peace back to South Sudan.
We are under duty because we are the instruments of peace. So let us all come together, unite our ranks, forgive ourselves, and work for peace in our country so that our people can live in peace and harmony as came in our national anthem.
But he added, there have been unnecessary delays in the peace process. Among them, he says, is the creation of the committee that is supposed to discuss amendments to the South Sudan's transitional constitution. The peace deal brokered by the regional bloc IGAD calls for a transitional government to be set up by November and says one of the government tasks will be to draft a permanent constitution for South Sudan. But Makwi says that part of the peace deal is behind schedule. He says the committee will, in accordance to the agreement, help the Igaden mediation team in consultation with the parties to form the transitional government of national unity, among other things.
And by the way, this body should have set and accomplished its task within 21 days from the date of signature. Now it means that we are already behind schedule. And TZIGAD, which was supposed to constitute this body after receiving the nominees from the stakeholders.
President Kiir signed the peace deal on August 26. That means the Transitional Amendment Committee should have been set up 2 weeks ago. Mokwe told the prayer breakfast he hopes the blame for the delays to the committee is not laid at the feet of the government. Stepano de Leo, the head of European Union mission in South Sudan, says South Sudanese must themselves lead the initiatives to restore peace. But de Leo says he has seen positive signs since the IGAD agreement was signed last month.
Discussion is ongoing. We hope that this process will continue according not only to what is written in the agreement, which is quite important because it sets timetables and it sets many issues that will help to make the country grow, but it's the commitment of all of us that will make the difference.
He says the EU has always and will continue to support UPOD to bring peace back to South Sudan. National Assembly Speaker Manasseh Magog-Rundial called at the prayer breakfast for all South Sudanese to place their trust in God.
Let us surrender ourselves, our nation, to God. If we do that, our difficulties will be minimized. Let us avoid God's anger. We should not be happy when God is angry with us, like what we have done on the 15th of December.
Rundial was referring to the day that South Sudan erupted in conflict. IGAD spent 20 months trying to negotiate an end to the conflict and finally achieved some success last month when President Kiir and Riek Machar both signed an agreement to end the fighting. In spite of that deal, however, clashes have erupted around the country and South Sudanese are still dying as they are caught up in the clashes or of anger and disease. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, residents in Jonglei receive skills training at a new vocational center. That story is coming up after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what are the main things that matter to you in life?
My family and my dress. I love whenever I look good and people talk about it, that, oh, your dress is good, everything about you is good. That is what I love.
Doing my things in the right time, my future, my education, my family.
One of the things, as I've told you, I'm a born-again Christian. When I received the gift of salvation, I felt good, and so it was not something easy.
Life, me, is all about faithfulness and honesty. Yes, I know with that, everything is possible. When you're faithful to your partner or your co-worker, those things will definitely push you far.
I think education matters so much. I put it as first, and also God, because if I don't have God in my life, I don't think anything can rhyme.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The caretaker governor of Central Equatoria State, Juma Ali Mallow, yesterday sacked several ministers of his 14-seat cabinet. It is the second time in 2 weeks that Mallow has reshuffled his cabinet, and some local officials are saying these changes can cause instability. Tito Justin has this report from Washington.
It is unclear how many cabinet members are being fired by Mallow this time around, but State Information Minister Emmanuel Adili says this latest reshuffle is intended to improve the lives of Central Equatorians.
It is meant to inject new blood to make sure we consolidate our talents and ability to deliver service. This is just meant to the overall objective of any government to deliver service to the people. We need to support His Excellency Juma Ali Mallow, our caretaker governor, in his pursuit to promoting and consolidating unity of the people of this state.
The cabinet members who were fired by Malawi yesterday had been in office since January this year. They were all appointed by former Governor Clement Wanikonga, who was removed from office last month by President Kiir. No reason was given for Konga's removal. Malawi has nominated local legislators Tom Sebit, Dabe Francis and Oliver Mule to fill empty cabinet positions, include those of the fired cabinet members. The new appointees will have to be vetted by the state legislature before they are sworn in. James David, executive director of the Foundation of Democracy and Accountable Governance, a local NGO, says he likes the fact that the new appointees are young.
These governors have got special regard to what we call the sunrise generation. Most of these ministers that have been appointed are people probably less than 40 years. So this is a clear signal that there is a huge preference on the performance of young people in leadership in this country. So this appointment should translate into effective service delivery. I expect that these guys who are coming in should not just be there as ministers, just sitting in their offices, but they should go running and improve services to the people of this state.
David says he expects the new cabinet to focus on issues that matter to ordinary citizens in the state, including job and security.
The reality is that there is a big threat to livelihoods and to the safety of citizens of Central Equatoria in all the various counties. See the Kajukeji Road. 2 days, 3 days ago, there has been some kind of robbery on the road. Yei Road has problem. Terekeka Road has problem. That means that the government of Central Equatoria and even the national government need to take priorities to improve security.
But David says the new cabinet members need to be given time to deliver services to the people. He says changing the makeup of the cabinet so often does not give officials time to find their feet and do their jobs effectively. It also does not inspire confidence in the officials.
In future, we may need probably to do a little bit of reforms. Because what does it take if a minister is appointed today, then in the next 6 months, 7 months, he's fired? That means every minister that is appointed will only work under the pretext that you never know, within a very short time, I may be fired. And therefore, the level of commitment as compared to a minister that will be given time to serve in that particular ministry will be actually less. This would mean that the impact of that minister, either as an individual or as a ministry, will be less.
For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Washington.
That report was prepared in Juba. A new vocational training center in Jonglei State is offering young people and other South Sudanese the opportunity to learn skills for full-time work. Locals are being taught how to be electricians, carpenters, and construction workers. For VOA News, Jacoba Chek has this story from Bor.
The Christian Vocational Training Center in Jonglei State, which opened its doors in February, has just graduated its first batch of students. George Otieno, who teaches carpentry at the center, says most Jonglei nationals typically do not like performing carpentry work or similar jobs.
In this country, we don't see people loving this work so much. And I don't know why, because people fear to work with their hands. People just need the work of the offices, and they don't want this work of carpentry or the work of hands that people are using. I don't know why, but we love it because when you are self-employed, you can earn a lot in your life more than working in the offices. And that's why I think it is better for them to work with their hands to gain more things in their life.
Otieno says in Kenya and Uganda, many people are self-employees and they often earn more money than government workers. He says in South Sudan, it is the foreign nationals who do most of the work involving hand labor. Gag Garang Gag, a student at the vocational center, says taking technical courses is the best kind of training for getting a job.
So basically, some people can think that this vocational is obviously for just handwork. But it is whereby you can practice, though in theory and even in practical, because you can do them both. If you do it in theory, you go out in the field and you do it practically.
Gag says he attend the vocational school so that he can learn technical skill to help develop his hometown of Bor. Amor Daruka Anyes studies computer training at the school. She is calling on the Jonglei State's women enrolled at the school to learn more than computer skills.
There is a gap there in the office for you ladies when you are done with computer. Even if you compete with 10 men and you are only one girl there and you are done with computer, you have chance to defeat those men. So what I'm telling you, if you are willing to study or if you want to make your future bright, don't be just there around. Go to Malawi, go where. Just come and study and you will see the change.
Joseph Odema, a deputy dean at the vocational center, says the school offers computer technology, electrical engineering, carpentry and masonry, and they are looking to expand their courses offerings to attract more students.
When you look at the Jonglei State itself, it's a developing state in South Sudan. And when we went out there looking for the people who can do some vocational skill, we found out that most of the people here are hiring experts from either Uganda, Kenya, and other parts of the world. So we look at the energetic youth that are in this place here who can provide these services at a cheaper cost.
41 are currently enrolled at the school. Taking one course costs about 750 South Sudanese pounds, which is paid in full by the students. I am Jacob Achek reporting for BOA News in Bor.
The United Nations holds a high-level meeting today to discuss the migrant and refugee crisis in Europe. Before the meeting, UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, released a new report that says conflicts and instability in five countries, including some in North Africa, have uprooted at least 4.5 million children. Sarah Crowe is UNICEF's Chief of Crisis Communication. From UN headquarters in New York, she spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapo about how the migrant and refugee crisis is affecting children.
Children are really at the heart of this crisis. We've seen the heart-rending pictures that have really pulled at the heartstrings of people around the world and really triggered off this deep sense of compassion and solidarity all around Europe as children are on the move. But it's also a reminder, really, of what's happening on the ground in Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the neighboring countries that have shouldered the biggest burden of the refugee crisis there. We know already that 2.7 million children, Syrian children, are out of school, and one out of every four of their schools are destroyed. So this is a reason why they are on the move. We should not be surprised that the crisis is what it is right now.
Now, what is the condition of the children? Are you finding them more susceptible to the stress of this crisis?
Well, children always do have an element of resilience. But what we're seeing at every step of the way, whether it's in the refugee camps in Syria and the neighboring countries, or indeed where the majority of refugees and displaced children are, which means they're in host communities, or children on the move through countries such as Serbia, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and Croatia, and then as they move into Western Europe. And UNICEF is quite unlike many of the other agencies as we're involved in various levels, you know, whether it's in the industrialized countries with Germany, Austria, and so on, and offering our assistance and our expertise in child protection there, or indeed in a very sort of hands on the ground in the neighboring countries as well as the countries that children are passing through. And what our colleagues are telling us and what they've seen are children are exhausted. They're dehydrated very often because they've been walking a long time. I mean, the majority of them are combining their journey with taxis, buses, some on foot, some on trains, as we've seen. And of course, this means that they have blisters, that they're exhausted, that they're not getting proper food along the way, really, because they're living on canned foods and dried foods. So they're in need of kind of decent hot meals, but they very often do not want to stay in the countries that they're passing through with their families, of course. And we're now looking at 133,000 children between January and July who have sought asylum in Europe. And this, of course, then underlines further how this is hitting children. It's an 80% increase on the numbers of children who sought asylum from last year.
But the children are not just from Syria, are they?
Absolutely not, no. The majority are from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq, but then they're also some who are coming through from various other parts, such as Eritrea, Somalia. But if we look at the movement of people and children globally, the majority of refugees do go to the countries that are right next to the countries that are in conflict or from which they're fleeing. So that means that Somalis go to Kenya, that people in South Sudan go to Uganda, and it's the generosity of those countries that have, you know, hosted refugees over a long period of time that really is remarkable, and we have to remember that that's how to deal with it.
Sarah Crowe is UNICEF's Chief of Crisis Communications from UN headquarters in New York. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapo earlier today. From New York, we move to Geneva, where the World Health Organization is publishing new guidelines on the treatment of HIV/AIDS that it says could end the AIDS epidemic by 2013. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
In a significant departure from current practice, the World Health Organization recommends that anyone infected with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, should begin antiretroviral therapy as soon after diagnosis as possible. In an interview with VOA, Coordinator for Treatment and Care for HIV/AIDS, Meg Doherty, says clinical trials show early use of antiretroviral therapy keeps people with HIV living longer, healthier lives while reducing the risk of transmitting the virus to partners.
We also believe that by starting more people earlier on therapy, we will have an opportunity to end AIDS by 2030. And ending a public health epidemic does not mean that there will be no evidence of the virus at all, but it will mean that there will be an ability to have fewer new infections than those who are on therapy at the same time, and that there will be fewer and fewer people being infected over time.
The World Health Organization also recommends preventive antiretroviral treatment should be offered to people at substantial risk of HIV, such as men who have sex with men or injecting drug users. It adds this preventive therapy should be part of a comprehensive package of services, including HIV testing, counseling, and support. An estimated 15 million people are on antiretroviral therapy. Based on the new recommendations, this number would expand to 37 million people, a target the WHO says it hopes to reach by 2020. Meg Doherty says it would cost $18.4 billion every year over the next 5 years to expand access to treatment services. But she says every dollar invested in HIV treatment would return $15 in improved health and fewer infections and could help avert 21 million AIDS-related deaths by 2030. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that report by Lisa Schlein brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We have been listening to this West African musician who is saying, if it's your birthday, make some noise. And indeed, if it's your birthday, you make some noise out there. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.